This is side two of the Chuck Curry interview. When the tape ended, we were talking about the 1960s admission staff at Michigan State, and you were commenting about the secondary. Most of the people at that time had secondary schools experience.
And by the late 60s and early 70s, a lot of the people that we hired came out of the residence hall system at Michigan State. People who finished master's programs and served as advisors in residence halls and so on. And that was a good source of talent. We got some good people out of that, one of whom, Tom Goodale, who came back for their service last week, is now the executive director of the Sigma Alpha Epsilon National Social Fraternity, which is headquartered in Evanston, Illinois. He has served 10 years in student affairs and as vice president. He's Denver, Virginia Tech, William & Mary. I'm missing one or two others. He's mm-hmm. had quite a career. Mm-hmm. We had a former state superintendent of public instruction on our staff in the 60s, handling graduate admissions, and it was just a phenomenal bunch of people, who, all of whom went on to bigger and better things at some point in their careers. And that can never be matched again, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
Did you see change in the university in those years that you were gone, away at Hope? And when you came back, was there any either qualitative or quantitative difference that to speak of?
Other than the level of activism you mentioned before, mm-hmm. I mean, clearly that was different. There was, you know, at the front doors of the admissions office, the administration building, there were locks installed that could be triggered by the receptionist in case there was somebody who wanted to storm the office. Mm-hmm. There was a sit-in in the Hand administration building at one point in time during that period, and they just wanted the ability to, because of the security of the records and so on, to be able to shut the doors instantaneously. And certain people had in the office had keys that could override that system or whatever. So, you know, mm-hmm. you were sensitive to that. But other than just the general activism that the kids possessed, it filtered back to the high schools to some extent. But it never really affected the way we operated in admissions. One of the nice flavors about being an admissions officer and dealing with high school kids is you have something they want. If they seriously want to be in college, they're going to be on their best behavior when they're in your company. Whether it's one-on-one with or without their parents in an interview in the office or in a group situation in the high school or at a college night program. Mm-hmm. There's an occasional exception to that, but yeah. Not very much.
Yeah. My wife and I both taught driver's ed for 13 years in public schools, and so we know that. We know that feeling. So the students that typically were trouble students, they were on their best behavior. Straight A's in driver's ed. So we kind of know that same feeling. Did your duties change at all when you came back?
When the year I came back, another couple of colleagues left. One had left the year I came back, besides Lorne Kerr, who went to Northwestern Michigan College in Traverse City, Community College, and was a vice president there, and pretty much spent the rest of his career there. Should have become president, probably, but never did. Dave Hershey was on our staff. He left the year after I came back to become director of admissions at the University of Texas in Austin, and was there, I don't know, perhaps 10 years, and then became director of admissions at the Illinois Institute of Technology after that, before he retired. When Dave Hershey left, he was basically, our titles weren't always very descriptive. There was a director, several associates and several assistant directors, and then admissions counselors was the entry-level position. And so that wasn't descriptive, but Dave Hershey was basically coordinator of freshman admissions. And when he left, I took that job. So until I retired in 93, I was basically supervising the activities of the recruitment of high school seniors.
Okay. Were you involved in the academic orientation program in that, or no?
No, not directly. That program was run out of the admissions office. That was something that Gordon Sabine got going. In fact, at one point, when we put in a parents' orientation program in the 60s, it got us some mention in Newsweek magazine because that was a rather new phenomenon. Now everybody does it, but to include parents in the orientation process was pretty distinctive back then. But AOP has always been run out of the admissions office because of Sabine's initiative in that regard. It hasn't always sat well with other parts of the campus necessarily, but what our staff did was we monitored or moderated, if you will, the parents' side of the program. Once the students checked in, of course, orientation was basically a 24-hour experience overnight, and starting one day and ending the next day at noon. And once the kids checked in, they were separated. Students went off to do their thing, and the parents collected those who came. That was strictly voluntary, of course. Those who came, this was mostly in Holden Hall, had a session over there, and the admission staff would take turns moderating those programs. And for some of us, they were a lot of fun. You could just have a ball with the parents and joking, kidding around. But you'd bring different resource people, academic advising, campus health, the Olin Health Center, the campus police, security people from the residence halls would all come and make presentations. And when Dr. Horton was here as president, he used to come over whenever he was able and in town and make some remarks to the parents. Mm-hmm. And that was impressive. The president of the university taking the time to spend a half an hour, 40 minutes with the parents, even answering questions. Mm-hmm. And he was terrific at it. He was just a great guy in a public setting. And that continued, I don't think that, not through Dr. McPherson does it, but it continued through a couple of other presidencies. That was our job as far as the orientation. There was somebody on the staff who was, in fact, the director of the academic orientation program, and he or she was the chief honcho of that and hired the so-called Spartan aides, resident assistants for the program and so on to help the kids through it.
Mm-hmm. So did you, in your duties, did you actually go out to high schools on a regular basis later in your... What was the... if you remember from the 70s, at any rate, what were the main pitches that you gave, emphasizing it? Obviously, our competition was
Michigan, and then we went out of state, of course. There were other universities, Big Ten primarily, that were in competition. I always, and we all had our little different ways of going about things. Tried to make sure that new staff members never copied others, but took good ideas from them. Mm-hmm. I always start talking about size. Size was sometimes perceived as a negative. This place was huge, overwhelming, and so I would often start out with dealing with size. Now, if I was with an out-of-state audience, and I used to recruit Chicago quite a bit, I would start out by just identifying where Michigan State is and start with a Stroman map of the campus and so on. and I would talk about the physical dimensions of the campus, the mile wide, 2 miles deep, whatever, in terms of the academic portion, and say, how does Michigan State deal with that? What does Michigan State do to become a small university? Well, one way is transportation system, the bus system. The bicycle paths, but one of the most important things is the class schedule. The fact that there's 20 minutes between classes was always a plus, and because hardly any other universities did that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they still do, but still don't. But that, therefore, you could talk to kids in terms of getting, you could get to class, from class to class in consecutive periods on foot. You didn't necessarily have to bicycle or use the bus. So that helped. The fact that students could eat their meals, particularly lunch, in any residence hall on campus, which gave them a couple dozen choices of location depending on their schedule, was another way to deal with it. And then you talk about the two residential colleges, at one time three, Justin Morrill, James Madison, and Lyman Briggs, all of whom Gordon Savine was instrumental in getting going, by the way. So that for some students, there was a place for them to have an environment that was not unlike a Kalamazoo College or a Hope College or something like that, without losing the resources of a major university. So as Lyman Briggs's motto became, the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. So that was a plus. And then for the elite, bright kids, you could talk about the Honors College, because that was another way you broke down the university for certain kids. And you talked about class sizes. Percentage at that time of graduate students who were doing primary teaching was very small, particularly among our peer institutions. So you could tell kids they were getting the regular full-time professors, even in the required university college courses. So you could spend quite a bit of time on that to try to be concise and succinct in doing so. I would usually just make a segue by saying, okay, now that you all want to come to Michigan State, I would talk, in the meantime, I would have talked about the academic programs, all the choice. Another thing that was, another flexibility item that was extremely useful here was the university college. The fact that a student could start as a no-preference student, as probably a third to a half did at that time, and then proceed to change their major as often as they wanted to the first couple of years, and at least half changed their major at least once, I think. That was a level of flexibility. And pointing out to these kids, hey, look, you're at a stage of change in your life, and we've got programs at Michigan State you've never heard of before. Mm-hmm. And I often use food science as an example. I would say in the freshman class there will be less than six kids will identify food science as the major when they enter. And we will graduate, a dozen, two, three dozen students 4 years mm-hmm. later in food science. Mm-hmm. What happened? Mm-hmm. There's a discovery process going on. Mm-hmm. I also point out that that's what the university college is for. That's also a chance for you to become aware of and abreast of, and in some cases get some depth on disciplines you haven't had a chance to in high school. And that those aren't just required courses. That's your liberal education, if you will, and your foundation for it. I used to use an analogy with Time magazine. I told them that once I'd gotten through my college education, that and my family had always subscribed to Time, and I always have since, that once I had that liberal education, I could then read every section of Time magazine and understand and get something out of it. Because it's compartmentalized, still is. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating to do that. And so this is why you get a liberal education. I'm trying to make it simplistic. Mm-hmm. Parents liked it. So then you'd move on after you talked about the university as an environment, and then as about the academic environment and the choice and so on. I would talk about the admissions process. And a lot of people and a lot of schools start out talking about that. And if you do that at the first, I felt you would turn off some kids. There would be some marginal kids, and then they'd say, gee, I may be on the cusp here, I may not get in, and they just kind of forget the rest of the presentation. Mm-hmm. So you try to entice them into being interested in Michigan State and enhancing that initial interest they show of coming to you, and then talk about the admissions process, and then explain to them that it was selective, and how we went about it. And I used to use an axiom, and I don't know if I necessarily invented it, and maybe one of my other former colleagues did. I call it PQ, performance predicts performance, which simply means that Your performance in academic subjects in high school is the best predictor of success in college. Not the only predictor, but the best one. And therefore, test scores are secondary. And it is possible for you to have grades and a record so good in high school, we would admit you without looking at test scores. And that would ease the mind of a lot of kids who were up a little concerned about their test results. It was particularly useful in out-of-state kids, particularly in Illinois, because the University of Illinois, and may still, I'm not sure, well, Stan Anderson may change that, they have to be very selective. You have to realize Illinois has a population larger than Michigan, and they only have one Big Ten university, flagship university, if you will, public, whereas Michigan has two. And therefore, getting into Illinois, which has a population significantly less than Michigan State, is extremely tough, and everybody wants to go there. So the selection standards are very high. And so test scores are extremely important, as is class rank at the University of Illinois. And we were able to go to to the Chicago area and say, look, test scores are secondary, and so is class rank. And in fact, we don't even use class rank for admission, because class rank is determined by different methodologies in different schools. And rank can mean different things in different high schools, and it also doesn't necessarily reflect the caliber of your student population either. So I say we look at it, we're curious about it, but we don't use it. And so it's your performance in your school that determines your admission primarily, but the lower your grades are, the more important the test scores come. It's an inverse proportion. And it used to be fairly effective, and of course you could, in Chicago you can just see kids, when you downgraded the importance of test scores, a sigh of relief would come out of about half the kids. they were amazed. So you talked about the admission process and who gets in, and who, and then I would identify for them. And although I had introduced myself by name at the beginning of the presentation, or that they were looking at the guy that was going to make the decision. Because I was doing a college night presentation in Chicago area or at a Michigan high school that was my responsibility, their application was coming to my desk. Uh-huh. Okay. And that's the way we divided things over there, and still do. So that when you visit high schools, you get to know that high school as best you can, and the counselors, of course. But I just tell kids, I said, I'm the guy that's going to say yes, no, or maybe. And that's the way I describe the decisions we made. Mm-hmm. Yes, no, or maybe. Again, simplify things for them. Make it very, very easy for them to understand. Yes means, we like your academic record. We think you'll succeed at Michigan State. Welcome. You're a Spartan. And you know, most applications result in that pretty early. Maybe means we're not sure. We want more information, and we want to perhaps get another SAT or ACT score that you may have told us you're going to take. More likely, we will defer a decision for seventh semester grades, first semester senior year. Did that with a lot of kids back in those days, 60s and 70s and 80s. They don't do much anymore because the volume of applications and the caliber is such that there's a waiting list starting by Christmas time. Mm-hmm. So it's a different phenomenon than when I was here. Mm-hmm. But a maybe decision, I used to tell them, covered a multitude of sins, and I said it also may be affected by the trend in a grade. I said, we read your file chronologically. 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, each year is succeedingly more important than the previous one. And therefore, since they were now seniors, this was even the most important year, or could be, for some of them. So we would defer a lot of kids for seventh semester grades, and if I used to tell them, if you produce in academic courses, math, science, English, social studies, and foreign language, and I used to call it the Big Five, I said, the other courses we don't even consider. He says, you're talking about predicting college success, and the courses that will best predict that are not the art courses, the shop courses, the phys ed. Fine. What is your grade average in academic college prep subjects? And then I would give them a range of where what we were looking at as a kind of a minimum, which is would generally be B-minus area at the time. Now it's B-plus. Explained to him that the trend in grades from 1 year to the next, one semester to the next, played a part, whether it was an upward trend, downward trend, whatever. It told us that there was a message there. So that could produce, even though the record could be fairly decent overall, the recent trend might have been such that we would defer a decision. And I told him we could have two kids with identical grade averages and one's not admitted and one is. It's how you got that grade average. What's the quality of your program and what trend produced it. So there, that was the admission process. Then you go into talking, then you discuss financing education. How do you pay for it? And you talk about the various loan programs and, you know, as federal, state programs came into play, you mentioned those, and Michigan State's own scholarship program. And if you assumed in a large audience, you had a few really bright kids in there, so you talk about the Alumni Distinguished Scholarship Program very briefly. And with it, and back when we were talking about academics, I'd always throw in a mention of the Honors College. I don't think my colleagues always did, but I always did. Mm-hmm. I always assumed, unless I could had a small group and could kind of read their faces, that they weren't very that bright. I would tell them what the Honors College was very briefly. And now we always had brochures and that stuff too. But talk about the ADS program and what the opportunities were at Michigan State scholarship-wise, and deadlines and so forth. Then at the end of that, I'd say, okay, now you all want to come to Michigan State. You've all determined you can get in. You've all figured out how you can pay for it. Should you come? What about the decision-making process? What's involved with it? What role do your parents play? And I would try to emphasize in an audience that had parents that the decision was the kid's decision, not the parents. The parents had an influence in two ways. One, geography and finances. And that was it. And those can be very important decisions, obviously, but other than that, parents should stay out of it. facilitate it, but not make the decision.
Was your going to Denison, did that come in? did you think back to
well,
that?
Well, yeah, but you know, it was such a different
but a positive thing.
Sure. There was no high school counselor in my high school. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go to Albion College, which was right next door, just because it was too close. Uh-huh. My parents had advanced degrees in Michigan, but although I went to football games down there, I wasn't really attracted to going there. I had no perception of the place in terms of size, so, you know, I just... But, yeah, that did cross my mind. Mm-hmm. So, and I'd go through, I told them, you know, don't choose a college site unseen, which basically I had done. I literally had not seen Denison's campus until I walked in there as a freshman. I said, you know, don't do it sight unseen. Be sure you visit. Be sure you, and if you're not sure what the concept of size is, go visit a small college, a medium-sized college, like a Central, a big college like Michigan State or Michigan or whatever. And visit more than once. And then go visit, if you've got friends on that campus from previous years who are students there, go stay with them in the dorm for a day or two. Go to class with them. I said, you'll be welcome. Mm-hmm. So I just laid out a whole procedure to go through to make sure he made the right decision. He said, we hope you choose Michigan State. But that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is you choose the place you feel most comfortable. And only you can decide that, not your parents.
Mm-hmm. Was your work targeting mainly, you mentioned Chicago, you mentioned Detroit area. Did you have anything recruiting in northern Michigan or in the rural UP? Was the message different? That you, if you ever had any experience up there, or did you mostly concentrate on the larger urban schools?
I was suburban Detroit for most of the time, and I'm trying to think what I did do Macomb County for a while. There were some rural schools there. Did some work in the Saginaw Midland areas, which includes rural too. Other than that, not a lot. I never did the Upper Peninsula until 2 years ago. I didn't have mentioned this, I haven't had a reason to. I've been working part-time ever since I retired. I retired in 1993. And I worked part-time at this university every academic year since, for part of the academic year, but just part-time, you know, 12, 15 hours a week. The last several years, that has been in the admissions office. and probably will be again this year, starting probably this week. So anyway, as it happened 2 years ago, they had lost a staff member very late in the summer, and that was the person who covered the Upper Peninsula. There's a big swing of about 10 days up there in which all the colleges all descend on the UP. Mm-hmm. And to make it efficient, there are college nights every night and day up there. And so they asked me if I would do it. So I did. This was right after 9/11, of course. Mm. And I'd never done that before. I'd been in the UP, but I'd never done that trip. So I did. It was kind of fun. But yeah, it's a different. There's a different level of sophistication there, and I don't know. I guess you could say, for the most part, kids aren't so full of themselves. They can be in some of the suburban areas.
Yeah. Did you see any differences in that in terms of did UP students coming here succeed as a rule or?
No,
we know our basketball coach has, but.
I didn't have a chance to really follow up on that. And good follow-ups really were just coming into play when I retired. they now have among their admissions tools that they use a predicted GPA, which is based on a certain minimum critical mass of students over the recent years, perhaps the last six or seven, that come from a given high school and how they have succeeded in their freshman year at Michigan State. So when a student's application from one of those schools that has that minimum critical mass comes to Michigan State, his high school GPA is factored into what the high school GPA of all the previous kids from that school was and what kind of results they got at Michigan State, so you can predict what they are likely to do in their freshman year at MSU.
Mm.
And so you set kind of a minimum expectation as to what will be the threshold for admission. That's only one of the tools, but mm-hmm. it is a very helpful one. We didn't have that back then.
Yeah. Interesting. What do you see in looking at, you know, the breadth of your career, the challenges? Have they changed for admissions officers, not just at Michigan State, but just in general? Or are they many of the same problems that you faced, or have they changed at all?
Yeah, well, I think they're similar and probably they vary in degrees. I would not like to be a so-called road warrior this year, I don't think, given the budget the university is going through, budget problems, the resulting tuition increase, and now on top of that we learned today that there's another deficit in the state budget, which could impact universities before the school year is out, and indirectly, obviously, tuition fees next year. College is going to be a hard sell, I think, to a lot of families. Plus, you know, the economy isn't fully recovered yet. You've got a lot more unemployed people around the state than we used to have. So, you know, it's still. And college education is still, kids still aspire to that, and parents still aspire for the kids. But the finances are more critical. I mean, financial aid is going to be more and more and more relevant thing. You just probably have to spend more time talking about it. I don't know. But as a consequence, I think I assume it's been this year. Although, you know, I'm not in the inner workings of the office enough to know all this stuff, but I would presume that one of the biggest competitors for Michigan State this year will be community colleges, not the University of Michigan. That will still be there, obviously,
mm-hmm.
and the Centrals and Westerns. It'll be community colleges. They're because they're less expensive and more accessible in some respects for a lot of kids.
Mm-hmm.
They might kind of end up doing, and that's usually true. That's been a phenomenon over the years.
In economic downturns.
Community colleges do well,
mm-hmm.
enrollment-wise, and when things are well, then the four-year colleges do better.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So. You've already mentioned your retirement, 1993. Mm-hmm. You said,
right?
But that you were also working on a part-time basis. Did you have any university contacts outside the office that you maintained in terms of sports support or anything like that you were Since your retirement, were you active in any groups? And
No, not really. One of the duties I had from, excuse me, one of my colleagues was Chuck Seeley, who was director of admissions in the 70s, and he parted ways with Michigan State. I'm trying to think. Somewhere around 1980 sometime. I became director of admissions at East Carolina, and then retired from there and moved back here to Lansing. I don't know if he's on your list of oral history, but he might
be a good choice.
He would probably be a good, because he came in 65 to Michigan State, became director in the early 70s, and then was here basically